production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
Getting to produce things and share them with others is a deeply satisfying practice, and it also does something that a lot of the time people experiencing poverty maybe don't get as much access to, which is like being considered experts in their field and getting credit for the work that they do.
This week on Earth Eats, we visit a food pantry that hosts a seasonal farm stand. It's part of their efforts to break systems of social isolation that so often go hand in hand with poverty and food insecurity. And Jackie B. Howard is back with a warming winter recipe to enjoy tonight or freeze for some future night when you don't have time to cook. Your future self thanks you in advance. We've got that, plus food news, and a story from Harvest Public Media about H-2A visas and their effect on agriculture. All just ahead, so stay with us. Alex Chambers is back this week with some food news. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks, Kate. Good to be here. The news this week is about cows. Climate change is making things harder for ranchers, and dairy farms are turning their milk into powder and sending it overseas. Dennis Toddy with the U.S. Department of Agriculture helped author the National Climate Assessment that was released late last week. He says ranchers and feedlots will need to look for solutions to hotter temperatures and prolonged periods of drought in order to keep cattle from being stressed.
Can we relocate northward? Are there different breeds that handle different types of conditions? You could try that.
Research from the University of Nebraska shows cattle ranchers are already dealing with warmer and more humid summer conditions, which they say causes animals to eat less. To meet China's demand for cheap animal protein, dairy-producing countries like the U.S., the European Union, and New Zealand have retooled their operations in order to export massive amounts of powdered milk. In 2014, the industry group Dairy Farmers of America helped build a huge milk powder plant in Fallon, Nevada, to target the growing market in China. Soon afterward, a dairy with 8,000 cows moved to Smith Valley, about 80 miles from the plant. Concentrated dairy operations like these bring noise, stink, flies, and light pollution. Residents have already filed a lawsuit claiming several code violations, and an investigation by Civil Eats found FDA reports that the operation overused an antibiotic used to treat infections. A trial is slated for early next year. Although dairy farms have increased their production since 1970, there are only about half as many as there were, and they're relying more and more on exports. But with an increased supply from New Zealand, milk powder prices are at a two-year low. And as President Trump's trade war with China has led to retaliatory tariffs on milk powder, mega powder operations face an uncertain future. And that's the news. Thanks to Harvest Public Media and Chad Bouchard for those stories.
And thank you, Alex Chambers.
My pleasure, Kate.
When American farmers are unable to find the labor they need, the federal H-2A visa program allows them to temporarily bring in workers from foreign countries. As Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, the visas are costly for farmers and the application process is time-consuming. Yet, the number of visas granted continues to climb each year.
For 100 years and five generations, Bruce Talbot's family has grown fruit on the western slope of the Colorado Rockies.
This is all peaches. And peaches have become our main thing.
Here in this high desert climate, farmers are known for the fuzzy fruit. It used to be that thousands of migrant workers came to this region each year for the peach harvest, But starting in the early 2000s, Talbot says the labor pool dried up. He's diversified his crop from just peaches to grapes, cherries, and pears, because they all ripen at different times of the year.
There's not a labor pool that would allow us to pick that volume of fruit all at once.
But farmers, especially if they grow fruit and vegetable crops that have to be picked by hand, say they're not able to find labor locally anymore. So they're turning to the H-2A visa, so much so that a record number was granted in 2018, more than 240,000. That's a 21% increase from about a year ago. It's not a cheap program, and because of that,
it makes perfect economic sense to bring in workers for longer periods of time just because of that upfront fixed cost.
Fritz Soroka is with the Department of Ag Business at Florida Gulf Coast University. He says farmers are learning to adapt to the cost and becoming increasingly dependent on the program. Harvest Public Media analyzed data from the Department of Labor and found fruit farmers and ranchers in states like Colorado, Illinois, and Missouri bring in H-2A workers early, around February. They keep them for up to 6 months to prune, plant, harvest, and package. Roca says that's happening with Florida's citrus growers, too.
What people have been doing, the employers have been doing, is they bring in H-2A workers to harvest citrus, and they transition into these other crops, thereby extending their season.
Research from the University of California, Davis suggests Mexican workers who have traditionally had these jobs are now able to find work in Mexico thanks to an improved economy. And experts believe U.S. citizens are reluctant to take these jobs because they're seasonal and physically demanding. This year, Talbot contracted 42 H-2A workers. Like everyone, he's required to pay for the workers' travel, housing, and above minimum wage. He calls it a desperation program. Only 9% of the ag workforce is H-2A.
Expensive, cumbersome, slow to respond. We will start in a couple of weeks preparing for H-2A for next year, starting the advertising, the things that we're required to do.
Talbot says each worker has a fixed cost of about $1,000. He's learned that if he brings in workers at the beginning of the year and then keeps them working until late fall, he can still make a profit without having to raise costs for consumers.
We have planted crops that allow us to harvest over a long period of time. And a lot of what we are planting now is to fill in our slow periods.
The technology for fully mechanizing the harvest of hand-picked fruits like peaches is still a few years off. In the meantime, Roca says if farmers want a reliable source of labor,
you have one option, that's the H-2A program. There just aren't options for domestic workers, especially legal domestic workers.
The extra work is ideal for the visa holders, too, because it's more money. At age 66, Marcelo Hernandez Ramirez has worked for seven seasons on the Talbot farm, where in 1 hour he earns more than twice Mexico's daily minimum wage of just $5. He says men in his hometown often ask how they, too, can get this visa. As he talks, he cuts bunches of dark purple grapes from their vines. Like the other H-2A workers here, Hernandez Ramirez is from Mexico. Each year, he spends 9 months working on Talbot's farm, and then returns home for 3 months, where he works in crops of wheat, corn, and beans. Congress has said it's planning to modernize the H-2A program and make it easier to use, but currently, there's no limit on the number of H-2A visas permitted each year. So as long as farmers like Talbot need help, the workers will come. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
More news from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Our regular Earth Eats listeners might remember Jackie B. Howard. Jackie works here at the radio station, but she's cooked professionally for many years. She shared some fabulous recipes with us, though Jackie will be the first to tell you she doesn't really work from recipes. Coming up, you'll hear how she decides on certain ingredients and proportions, and the role of personal preference and tasting as you go in her method of cooking. Today, she's talking about her practice of cooking ahead.
Every Sunday, I make food ahead for the week. I like to use what I have on hand, figure out what I've got, and put some stuff together. Take a couple of hours out of the week and do it all at once, because I really hate coming home and having to cook after work. So Sunday, it's chill and quiet, and I get to just spend a couple hours in the kitchen, make dinners for the week, make lunches for the week. Sometimes I make things for the freezer. Today we are making something for the freezer, or I'll make snacks or something else fun or different.
Okay, that sounds like a lot of work. Is this going to be like an all-day event or?
Not all day, no. No, I mean, usually I'm like a 3-hour max on my day for the meal prep to get all of that done. I mean, can be fairly efficient. I've done it enough at this point to be efficient. Doing it all at one time and because I'm using what I have on hand, it's all here. It's using this similar ingredients and making them in different ways, and that cuts down a lot on the time.
Today, Jackie is making a white bean and kale soup using some cubed butternut squash that she had already roasted and some bratwurst that she had left over from a cookout.
I'm gonna go ahead and chop up kale. I'm going to saute the onions for the soup real fast and then basically get the soup going, and then it's on and ready to go. First, I'm going to go ahead and turn this pan back on so I can get the onions. I'm going to go ahead and add the olive oil to it, let that heat up just a little bit before I add the onions to it. And I did white onions. Chopping the kale, and I'm just giving it a rough chop. It's going to get cooked, so it's going to get cooked down. I'm not worried about big pieces of it or anything. One of the benefits of cooking this way and meal prepping specifically is that I'm going to get each of these meals down to like less than $2 or $3 a meal, and with good quality stuff in it, you know, like real, with a ton of vegetables. It's not mm-hmm. pasta that's cheap, you know, that yeah. you can do, and you know, it's
just a lot of whole food ingredients.
Yes,
not a lot of processed food or anything. Well, right. No processed stuff really.
Oh no. I try to avoid it as best I can. That olive oil is probably good to go at this point. I'm going to add these onions. And I'm just going to saute them up just to get... I'm not going to really caramelize them. Since I caramelized the brats, it's going to get that flavor in those. So I'm just going to get these going until they're translucent, because I'm going to cook them in the crock pot still. So I'm not that worried about it. I just want a little bit of brown, and again, get all those last bits of the brats that were in that pan too. Get that cooked up into those onions. I'm gonna add just a little bit of salt, a pinch and a half-ish, I would say. It was a 3-finger pinch. That's the exact science proportion of it. So you can see those are starting to get a little brown. Now we're making the kale and white bean soup. It has about 1/4 of a white onion, the 1 bunch of kale, and then I would say it was probably 2.5 to 3 cups of brats, chopped up brats in there. And then I have 2 cans of white beans, so whether that proportion really works or not, that's what's going in it, because I need to use them both. So hopefully it'll work out all right. When it comes to making food in general, but especially a soup or things like that, it's whatever you like. You know, do you like your soup to have lots of beans or no? That's up to you. You get to make it how you want. So I'm gonna put all these white onions right into the crock pot. I already have the brats, the kale. Now we're doing the onions. I'm gonna take some of that butternut squash and put in here. And I'm gonna reduce some of the beer, the rest of that can of beer, and some water with some spices in this skillet. And that's what I'm going to use as my stock.
So you're basically just building the flavor a little bit more quickly.
Yes. Since it's since I'm going to do water and not stock, and it doesn't have that flavor, some sort of flavor component to it, I want to go ahead and do it in the skillet first so that I can reduce some of the water content out of it, but still get it to a consistency that I need. I'm going to take this 16-ounce can of beer, fill it with water, and that's what I'm going to add to this beer. I'm going to throw the spices in. I'm going to reduce a little bit. I'm going to taste them and see what it tastes like. And then I can add it to my soup. I can adjust it from there. Smoked paprika is another one of those spices I think must be in your pantry. That smoke flavor to it adds so much depth, particularly for soups, meats. It's just really important to have. And it's such an easy go-to, but it does give that nice depth to it. I'm going to do paprika, mustard. And that's something too, what I think about when I'm making something for the freezer. I want it to stand alone on its own, so I could just pull it out and eat it. And I want it to be versatile enough that I can add, it can go a lot of different directions when I want to pull it out for something else. I am going to do thyme. That is another one of my personal favorites. For a soup, I'm going to go ahead and do garlic powder in it. For my slaw, I'm going to use fresh garlic. Use whatever you have. Oh, and I want white pepper. There it is. And these are just my go-to, like when I do a white bean soup. My mom always did white pepper in it. I don't know. Like a ham and white bean soup is what my mom always made. You know, serve over cornbread and it's delicious and wonderful and amazing. She did white pepper in it, and so that is like crucial to me for white beans that they have white pepper. If that's not your thing, you can do black pepper, it's fine. So I'm gonna take some of the thyme and the garlic powder and put it in my reduction right now. And the mustard. Okay, so this is starting to simmer just a little bit. We're evaporating a little. You can see that happening. I'm going to take about 2 teaspoons of garlic powder. I like garlicky things. My kale didn't get seasoned. The onions only got what salt and what was in the pan from the bratwurst. The bratwurst are going to be pretty heavily seasoned themselves, so I'm not too worried about that. But I want to make sure that I recognize my white beans are not going to get seasoned when they go in. So I need to make sure that my stock here is flavorful enough to flavor those things and still stay in and of itself flavorful when you eat it. About a teaspoon of ground mustard. But you could do a spicy mustard if you wanted to. You know, you could do a prepared mustard. Mm-hmm. A Dijon would be fine as well. And I'm just going to do like a half a teaspoon of paprika because I'm going to add more of that into my mix over here. Thyme, I'm going to do like a teaspoon on that. And then the white pepper, I'm actually not going to put into my stock. I'm going to shake it onto my veggies here that I've got in the crock pot. I'm going to go ahead and open up these cans of white beans. I'm leaving these beans just a little bit wet to add some liquid to the soup. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to toss those with a little bit of that white pepper. So I've turned this off, sort of stock, whatever we want to consider it.
That's amazing how like rich that looks already.
I could let it keep going, but since I want it as a soup, I want more liquid in it. I'm gonna go ahead and pull it. We're going to see if it tastes well enough to move it now and use it, or if I need to add more water, add more spices. It smells really good already, actually.
Yeah, it does.
So the beer's a little heavy in it, so I am going to add more water. And once the one thing to consider in this, right, so I'm tasting it as it is. This is not what it's going to taste like once it cooks with the brats and the veggies and the butternut squash that has cinnamon on it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to get more flavor to it. I'm tasting it to see, does it have the base that I need to get to the flavor that I want it to have? Mm-hmm. So I am adding about a cup of water, turning this back on. I'm going to add a little bit more garlic, a half a teaspoon of garlic. I am going to add more mustard to it, and I'm going to do more of that thyme as well. And I put that back into the pan and have the pan going just to like let me get this, warm up those spices that I just threw in. I'm not going to reboil this because I know I don't need to reduce it any further. I'm going to put all this right into my crock pot. Taking this and dumping it right over top of all the wonderful stuff for my soup.
That's going right into the crock pot.
As you look at it, it looks like there's not enough liquid for it because the kale is so poofy from being fresh. But once it cooks down a little bit, it's gonna release a little bit of moisture itself. It's gonna sink down into it, and the ratio is probably gonna be about right. I've got the sheet pan of butternut squash that looks so good. About a cup or a cup and a half of butternut squash in there. Okay, so crock pot's going. You can actually see it steaming already, which is awesome. So that is just gonna set. I'm gonna set and forget it.
So you've got it on high.
I do have it on high. I'd like to be able to get a sense of where it's at in a few hours, mm-hmm. and maybe be able to pull it and cool it so that I can get it in the freezer today.
Well, and when you think about it, most of the things are cooked. So you're just really trying to blend those flavors.
Exactly. Yep. Just giving it some time to hang out together. Yeah.
If you want to try making this soup or your personal version of it, find the basic recipe at eartheats.org. You can find other recipes there from Jackie B. Howard. Again, that's eartheats.org.
That's the eat trolley. and tuna group.
Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. If you're a regular shopper at a farmer's market, it's probably not just because of the food. Farmers markets are social spaces where people go to visit with their friends and also with the people who sell them tomatoes, sweet corn, or grass-fed beef. But those markets can feel more exclusive than some people like to admit. A food pantry in Bloomington, Indiana is trying to change that. Associate producer Alex Chambers spoke with people there.
Today I've got my great-grandmother's recipe up there for apple butter. Not the recipe, but I got the jars of apple butter.
Lisa Wilson and her husband, Kenny, have been selling at the farmer's market since it started 2 years ago.
And so you do that, what's making it pink? I said, well, I shouldn't be telling you, but it's red hots, you know? It's red hots to taste.
Red hots to taste. Her apple butter was quite tasty, but she's not likely to make a lot of money on it. This market is, I'm just going to say it, tiny. There are three vendors, along with a guitarist named Billy Young, a voter registration table, and a table with sample butternut squash hummus sandwiches. Customers are relaxed as they check out the wares. Allison Pepper is trying to figure out what she might be able to take home.
I'm not sure yet. I was hoping a sunflower, but I think my mom is getting three, and also I only have $1.
Are the sunflowers more than a dollar?
Yeah.
Allison is six. Her mom, Molly, is getting sunflowers. Big, dried heads.
I'll take $7 worth, if that's... Okay. If you have that many. One, two,
this market is taking place outside a food pantry here in Bloomington. It's called Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Locals know it as The Hub. The staff at The Hub started the market to make a space for people who might not be professional farmers, but still want to share food.
We knew there were a lot of community members who were already growing food at home, and that sometimes it was just an issue of disconnect physically, of getting one thing from one person to another. So that's sort of where the idea kicked off.
Hannah Lenchek is the advocacy coordinator at The Hub. She helped get the farm stand off the ground. That meant encouraging people to bring their wares. Lisa Land is selling those big sunflower heads, along with some decorative purple corn.
Then some different, just kind of end-of-the-year garden stuff, like basil, peppers. I gathered some persimmons, and then I have several handmade sewn items, like reusable menstrual pads, reusable Ziploc bags, cloth wipes, and blankets and banners.
Lisa is not a professional farmer. She and her husband grow most of their own food and spend their summers preserving as much as they can.
Really, last year what I would do was I would bring whatever to this market I got sick of preserving during that month, so then I could just get it out of the house. And I'm not pricing it to where I'm making a profit on it. It's just something like, all right, that pays off part of the seeds. Like, it's just all in good fun, I guess.
Lenchek says this is not a situation where farmers are going to make a living.
Most of our vendors have to travel to get here, and that means not only like the physical time that it takes to get here, but also gas money, which they have to balance with an understanding that they might not sell all of their goods at the farm stand.
So if the market's not providing a way for people to make a living, what is it doing? Why might vendors like Lisa and Kenny Wilson keep coming back month after month? You don't have to be experiencing poverty to be a vendor here. Or a customer, for that matter. But the pantry is trying to address food insecurity.
Statistically speaking, we know that social isolation and food insecurity often go hand in hand. Isolation can be both a cause and a symptom of food insecurity. I think it's really important to think about the ways that, again, people experiencing poverty a lot of the times are working against systems that really promote isolation.
In other words, people are trading more than food here. Billy Young is known for dedicating his songs to the vendors. And imagine going to a food pantry not for the free food, but because you have something to share.
Getting to produce things and share them with others is a deeply satisfying practice. And there are some ways that food in particular is commodified that can be really problematic for a lot of communities. And there are other ways that it really allows us to connect, even when it is through systems of money being exchanged. And the farm stand is, I think, the latter, that it presents people with an opportunity to sell things that they've made by themselves, that they're really proud of, and that they want to share with others, but that they may not have other venues for. That is really satisfying. And it also does something that a lot of the time people experiencing poverty maybe don't get as much access to, which is like being considered experts in their field and getting credit for the work that they do. And that's really where the farm stand steps in, is saying like, we trust our community members to be doing all of these things that they're already doing that are really incredible. And our job is not necessarily to like train people to do the things, although sometimes that's part of the work, but it's more like helping people build capacity and offering an outlet for it.
In any case, it's been worthwhile for Lisa Wilson.
I've met a lot of new people. I've learned a lot of different things, maybe on how to do this or how to do that. I think just being out of the house and around all these people, because everybody's pretty much have been pretty nice. And I've just really enjoyed being here doing this.
You can expect to see her here next year, whether it's with her Secrets to Apple Butter,
Red Hots to Taste,
or persimmons, peppers, or pearl onions. For Earth Eats, I'm Alex Chambers.
What has come down to be?
Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Thanks to everyone who helps out with the show, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Jackie B. Howard, Hannah Lenchek, Lisa Land, Lisa Wilson, Molly Pepper, Allison Pepper, and Billy Young. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. I produce the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.